You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. It's Monday, November 8th, 2010, and today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with John Turner, Vermont veteran and poet. After being discharged from the Marine Corps in 2007, John Turner moved to Burlington to escape the realities of military life and society. Following deployments to Haiti and Iraq, Turner suffered post-traumatic stress from the atrocities of war as an infantryman. He credits art, poetry, and performance with his ability to let go of the past, a time that was filled with hate and destruction. John says that although he was misplaced for 4 years, he feels positive about the fact that his writings, which are sometimes severe, and artwork have impacted people in positive ways. They also help him remember who he was before enlisting or signing on that solid black line, as he writes. John Turner says that although he can't go back in time to change the past, he can look back, learn, and progress forward. I'm very happy to have John with me in the Radiator studio today for a live interview. Hi, John.
Hi, Shayla. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Good.
I wonder if you can start out a little bit by talking about your background.
My military background?
Okay. Yes.
I joined the delayed entry program in between my junior and senior years of high school, so I was still 17. And then once I graduated high school, I had waited a couple months, and I was sent off to boot camp in August of 2003. And from there, I went through 3 months of boot camp and school of infantry training. And then 2 weeks after getting to my infantry unit in February of 2004, I was sent off to Haiti. And I was there for 3.5-4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty much just running patrols and... to be honest, like, sometimes I really don't know what we were doing there. We didn't know we were going to Haiti until the day before.
Mm-hmm.
We were on standby. It's called Air Contingency MAGTAF. And when we finally got there, it was definitely a very large culture shock, because it was the first time I had been on my own, been away from home. And here I am in some, you know, third world country where there's piles of trash in the middle of intersections, you know, almost two stories high, and all these children, they're bare, and these people are living in tin huts. And it was a very, very large eye-opener. I was there for 4 months and came back and did a workup for Iraq. So I was home for 7 months, and then I went to Iraq in January of 2005 and was there until August of 2005. Then I came home for another 7 months, and then went back to Iraq for another 7 months, and then came home, and I spent most of my time self-medicating, and finally trying to find an alternative method to deal with the experiences that I went through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you just mention where did you serve in Iraq?
The first time I was in between Fallujah and Abu Ghraib, in and out of this town called Nasr wa Salam, and then we also did some missions down in Amariya and Sadr Yusufaya, and then the second time I was in downtown Ramadi at the government center.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, John, what when you enlisted, what were you expecting or hoping for? Do you think that you were just so unprepared for what might be in your future?
I think that I was more prepared for the physical brutality that it would take. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, I was like, when I was in high school, I rode my bike everywhere. I lifted some weights. I was a wrestler. It was just kind of, I always like to put my body under like physical stress, I guess, in a good way, you know, to stay healthy. So I was prepared for that, but what I wasn't prepared for was what happened mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something they don't really talk about. You know, it's just when I was in the delayed entry program, we would get together for weekends and do physical training. So we'd do like push-ups and runs and crunches and stuff like that. And it kind of prepares you for that mentally. And during this time, it's just like you're being led by Marines that have been in for at least 4 to 6 years. So they kind of, they're recruiters, but they kind of like give you that very standoffish attitude. You know, I'm not going to take any bull from you. You know, you do what I tell you to do, and I'm going to scream because that's how it's going to be. So you're kind of like looking at these people like, are you serious? But it's just, you don't really think about it. At least I didn't. It was kind of one of those things where I've had a family member in every war since the Revolutionary War.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, the military runs pretty deep in my family, and I am breaking that cycle. but it's, you know, it's just kind of one of those things where I always knew I was going to be in growing up. I mean, my father met my mother in the military. My brother was in. Both my grandparents. Oh. You know, it goes back pretty far. But when you go into boot camp, like, you're not even off of the bus yet when you arrive in Paris Island, and you're already being screamed at by these drill instructors. And it's very overwhelming. It's kind of funny now that I think back at it, but these are people, like, that they do 3-month cycles, and they have to do a drill instructor tour of 3 years. So it's just like every 3 months, it's just like they're constantly stressing themselves out. And, you know, my senior drill instructor, he had hernias that kept coming back, and it's just the mentality of these men, these grown men, is absolutely ridiculous because they're just constantly angry. And it's whether they want to be or not, it's they have to be, because you have to train this new individual to lose everything,
sense of individuality.
Yeah, and become this machine, this basically trained machine, in order to be what they want you to be, you know. And it's absolutely
right.
Ridiculous.
Right, right. Well, I want to talk a little bit about what's happened to you and your journey since you've come home. One of the ways that we'll talk about that is through your poetry.
Mm-hmm.
You published a collection of poems called Eat the Apple. And one of the poems in Eat the Apple is titled Somniatic. And I'm wondering if you could read that for us now.
Yes. And I wrote this poem at a Warrior Writers workshop. The Warrior Writers group it was founded by Lavella Kalika, who is not a veteran but has been working with veterans since 2005.
Mm-hmm.
She's a Filipino, and she's an amazing person that has offered her heart to as many people that would love to just touch it and learn how to write. And I owe a lot of gratitude to her for kind of just making things available for not just myself, but family members and other veterans and
mm-hmm.
their family members.
Mm-hmm.
So this was written at the first Warrior Writers workshop that I went to in Fort Drum, New York.
And what year? That was 2005?
2007.
Seven, sorry.
Yep.
Right, okay.
I haven't slept in 3 days. I am tired. Closing my eyes does nothing for me. It gives me fear. Fear gives me rage. Rage makes my mind race. My racing mind keeps me awake. Staying awake drains my body. My drained body still produces energy. My energy makes me pace. Pacing tires my legs. My tired legs make me sit. Sitting makes my back sore. My sore back makes me lie down. Lying down makes me tired. Being tired helps me close my eyes, but closing my eyes does nothing for me.
Thank you for reading that.
Thank you.
I mean, there's two levels on when we talk about poems. There's what inspired you to write it, and then there's sort of the form of the poem and the creation of it itself. And just from that aspect, I really enjoyed the form of this poem and the way that it circles back to the beginning, especially since insomnia is one of those circular cycles that we can't get out of.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a very appropriate form. I'm curious if you still have trouble sleeping.
I do. I had a lot of trouble when I came off of all substances, because that was how I tried to sleep before. I have been sleeping a little bit better lately, and I'm very happy about that. And I don't know where it's coming from. I picked up the didgeridoo a couple months ago, and so that's kind of like reteaching me how to breathe. So I think that with that, it's just like I'm more consciously aware of actually breathing. So with that, you can relax yourself, and it has made quite a difference, I feel. But there's definitely times where I get back into my old habits, and it's just like I stay up and I pace back and forth very frequently, and I'll go from one room to the next, to the next, to the next. I'll sit down, I'll stand up, I'll try to write something, then I'll sit down, and then it's a seriously vicious cycle.
Right.
And I don't know, it's just, I go back and forth, I go through these waves. I feel that when I'm going into a hole, is when I stop sleeping again, and then it's just like as I'm starting to come out, it gets a little bit better. But I mean, post-traumatic stress is a constant roller coaster, and it's one of those things where you have to be able to accept it and live with it instead of just trying to kick it aside, because mm-hmm. it's always going to be there haunting you.
Mm-hmm.
So I've come to terms with the fact that I'm going to have it for the rest of my life, and that I'm sure some of my friends and my family members are going to have it for the rest of their lives. But if we continue to not think about it, or try not to think about it, then it's just going to keep building and building until it comes out all of a sudden and you're screaming at somebody and you don't even know why. And it's that goes, the insomnia like goes with it, and it hurts.
Did you have any problems along these lines before you were in the service, like attention deficit or anything that might seem at all related to the journey that you took when you went?
Not at all. I mean, I was a pretty, pretty relaxed kid. I spent a lot of time outside in the woods with trees, you know. I mean, that's where I was happy. You know, I mean, I had friends growing up.
It sounds like that will serve you well as you try to work through all of this.
No, I've definitely become reintegrated back with nature, so.
One of the lines in the poem that you just read is, "Fear makes me rage." And when I read that, I wondered, and maybe it doesn't have a specific answer, but I wondered, rage against whom or
anything? Myself, my most loved family members and friends, the military, war, homelessness, rape, just anything that's negative. It definitely started out being just with the military and my experience overseas, but you know, it's just like there's not every night I'm pacing up thinking about war. You know, so I'm obviously thinking about like the fact that there's this huge homeless population throughout the world, that there's people in different countries that have next to nothing, while there's people over here and then other well-to-do countries that have everything too much. But the basis of when I wrote that was fear kept us alive overseas. And I hate to say that, but that's just the way it was, because if you were constantly worried about dying, you're going to be more attentive to your surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
Checkpoint 295 in downtown Ramadi, I mean, it was constantly getting bombarded with IEDs and RPGs. And it's just, you know, if you're getting ready to go through this massive five-way intersection, it's just you're going to be looking at every single person, at every single bag, at every single rooftop, at every single window, every single everything, just to make sure that you guys are going to be safe when you go through with a 10-vehicle convoy. It's just, it's ridiculous, because that becomes your life. Fear becomes your life, and that's all you think about. That's all you are. And it, you know, it's just like when you're back home in the States, it's just, you know, you're still looking at windows, you're still looking at rooftops for snipers, you're still looking at recycling bins that are on the side of the street outside of a suburban neighborhood, you know, and you're wondering if that's going to blow up on you.
Yeah.
My partner and my dog and I, we were out in a park the other day, and it was a big open field, and I hadn't thought about this in a while, but there's been many nights where I had been walking through fields, you know, like in Iraq, and going into neighborhoods and into these streets, and it's just like I totally lost my I totally lost it because I couldn't stop thinking about patrolling down this neighborhood, you know, down near the Five Sisters, and it sucks because it totally takes over your life.
Right. You know. Right. It's like you're training yourself over there to not be able to recover over here.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have a nice statement, I guess, at the beginning of your collection, Eat the Apple, that explains a little bit of why you started writing poetry. I wonder if you could just read that statement for us.
Yeah.
It's
The writer's statement?
The writer's statement, I think that's...
Yes. Since getting out of the armed forces in 2007, I have spent many days and nights staring in and out of negativity while trying to find the right path. I wrote my first poem on a beach in 2006 at a time when I was on the edge of self-destruction. Since then, I've become sober and begun to let love back into my life. Some days are better than others, but there have been many reminders that have kept me from falling back into old habits. With the people that I choose to surround myself with, I have learned to express myself in ways that could seem unimaginable. Through writing and papermaking, I have finally found my voice and learned to embrace all that has been tormenting my being for far too long.
Thank you. I thought that was a nice summation of what you're trying to accomplish. And you mentioned two things in there. I want to start with Warrior Writers, the group Warrior Writers that you mentioned earlier. How did you initially become involved with Warrior Writers?
I was on my way to the first protest that I'd ever been to. It was September 28th of 2007 in Syracuse, New York. And before going there, we had met up with all these veterans that I had never met before, because the whole, like, I was just fresh out of the military. Everything was new to me. And I had met all these amazing people that were into vegan meals and Joanna Newsom and music and just, like, the overall well-being of humanity. And it was completely mind-blowing because I'd never been a part of that before in the military. I mean, my mother, she rose my brother and I well, but it's just, you know, this is completely different. It's like meeting this whole nother community of people that actually care about life. And they were writers, and they had told me then that, you know, there's going to be a writing workshop up at Fort Drum. Fort Drum is upstate New York. It's where 10th Mountain Division is based out of. And there was a coffee shop there called The Different Drummer, and where there was going to be a writing workshop. So we just went up there, and it was just like, oh, my God, this is perfect. This is amazing. And that was it. I felt this strong connection with writing as a means of expression, as survival. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I write because I need to. It's not like I do it because I love it. I do love doing it, but it's like I write because I have to write. I have to get this out, because if I don't, then it's just going to kill me. And you know, this my stories are only one of millions of other stories of soldiers that have gone in and out of war. You know, it's just like, if society can hear our stories, then maybe they can put some relationship to them and how the war has affected their lives and their family members' lives. And then it's just like, we'll finally get together and work towards this greater cause of peace.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I wrote my first poem on a beach in 2006. And when that happened, it felt like something was completely taking me over.
So you did that before finding the group?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you didn't ever write before you were in the service?
No. I mean, I journaled while I was in, so I'd keep, like, day-to-day events when I was in Haiti and Iraq. And I actually got made fun of my second tour in Iraq for keeping a journal. They'd be like, oh, Turner's writing in his diary again. And it's just like, you know, shut up, guys. I need to do this. But I still have that journal, and it's pretty amazing to look back and read the stories now, so I'm very glad that I did
do
that.
Sure.
But like in sixth and seventh grade, I loved writing. I never did any of my homework assignments, but I remember one in particular incident. Mrs. Smith, she was my seventh grade teacher. And
where was that?
This was in Vernon, Connecticut.
Okay.
A small town east of Hartford. And she had said that you need to stay after school because you haven't been doing your homework assignments, and you need to write because what you're giving me is crap. And that's ridiculous because I know you can write better than that. So I wrote this story for her, and she was like, why the F haven't you been doing this? I mean, she didn't say that, but it's just like, that's how I hear it in my head still. And it's just like, I don't know, it's just, it's in there. I mean, we all have our creative beings inside of us, and just if you are willing to look into yourself, then you can find it.
Right.
You can express yourself artistically, poetically, however you want.
Right, right.
You know?
I know that you've written some new poems
yes.
lately that aren't in Eat the Apple. I wonder if you want to just share one of those with us right now.
Yes.
Not the PTSD.
Okay.
We'll do that one later, but
yes.
maybe another one.
Yeah. These are all poems from my next book, which I'm assembling right now. The work is done. I've just put it together. But this is in the section called Street Dirt. And these are poems of pretty much observation about the streets, mainly Burlington. I mean, I've traveled throughout the country and been to different places with Warrior Writers and Combat Paper. But and it's funny because this is happening everywhere. Just the amount of litter, the amount of negligence towards the communities where communities live. It's a bit ridiculous, but this is a poem that I wrote up in the North End. Where are the beggars, the parkers, the trash throwers, collectors collecting cans for more cans? Where are the swindlers, the I-need-75-cent morers, those who ain't got a home? But I tell ya, there's been starers, look-the-other-wayers, paranoid high-class baggers walking down the streets. Tell them to go up north and watch them folk be aimless. Tell them to be yelled at 3 a.m. and all you is breathing. Tell them to live how others live, put their babies in they shoes. Then we might think different. Then we might know compassion, love, the severity of a church bell when the cold is coming. Then we might know what others don't got.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The severity of a church bill. I love that. That's great.
Thank you.
Have you ever lived on the street, John?
I was living out of my car for 3 months because I couldn't afford. I couldn't afford a place to live, and it was pretty rough. And then I found a place to live, and then I was also very drunk at the time. And my veteran friend and I, we got into a huge argument, and because of my post-traumatic stress and my drinking, and I had to leave. So I was back in a car with a dog for a little while, and it was, it sucked.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's just, you know, and I don't know.
When you talk about self-medicating and you talk about your alcohol problem that you've thankfully kicked,
yeah.
I'm curious, did the Marines offer any therapy or other benefits to help you transition back after 2007?
What they did was they gave a lot of people a hard time the first time we came back in 2005. This was the first time our unit had been deployed to Iraq. And post-traumatic stress wasn't exactly being recognized mm-hmm. at the time. So one of my good friends, he was my roommate, he had gone in and was just like, I need to see a psychiatrist because I'm having these issues and they need to be addressed. And we were actually told by other senior Marines to stay away from people like this because they could infect us. And it was completely kicked under the rug, just like, don't talk about it, don't do nothing about it. You just stay away from them because they're weak.
Wow.
You know, and it's absolutely ridiculous. But after the second time we got back, there was a lot more issues. They were starting to hand out prescription pills, anti-anxiety, and sleep meds when we were overseas. And it was a bit ridiculous. A lot more people were having issues. And when we came back, myself and a whole bunch of my friends, like, we went to the psychiatrist because we knew that there were issues. And it was more accepted this time, thankfully. And now it seems to be even more accepted, which I'm very happy about. But I think a lot of people are still confused about what to do and how to react
yeah.
with it. So when I finally got my psychiatry appointment, it took about three and a half months. And I went in there, and the first initial interview or meeting was probably about 30 to 45 minutes long. And we sat in there, and I gave him a brief history of what was going on, like history from growing up, because I'm dealing with psychiatrist, and so he obviously needs to know my history from growing up, and everything was fine. And then we start getting into the military stuff, and it's just like, you know, here it is. And what he did was gave me Zoloft, was an antidepressant, a sleep med, I don't remember which one, I think it was Seroquel, and then something else, Klonopin maybe. And it's just like, here you go, try this, you know, this will help. And I told him to begin with, I didn't want pills because I knew I had an addictive personality. My friend that the year before who had been going to a psychiatrist, he had gotten pills, and like, I mean, I'm not, you know, I was addicted to pills for before this happened, and I didn't want them because I knew it for that reason, especially since I was an alcoholic. I had already been through rehab within the military, and I just didn't want that stuff around.
Right.
And he's just like, no, it's okay, this will okay, this will work. And I'm just like, you know, very apprehensive about it. And then finally, it's just, I gave in. It was just like, okay. So I started taking these pills. And, you know, I started to feel a little bit better with the Zoloft and everything. And then it was just like, I started to see how I was reacting because I was still drinking. And then I started taking more pills and more pills and more pills. And then they weren't working. And I know part of that was because of the drinking. But, you know, it's just like every time I went back into the psychiatrist, he give me another prescription, and at one point I had 7 different prescriptions. I had Seroquel 25, Seroquel 100s, Klonopins, Lunestas, Trizodones, Ambiens, Zoloft, and Neurontin. So it's just like, why are you giving this kid this, you know? And it's just like, that's their excuse. And it's like, all my friends that had gone to see psychiatrists, it was just like they had these cocktails of pills that are driving them crazy, like making zombies out of them, and then they're having these ridiculous, like, rage fits, and it's absolutely absurd to think that this is how they're dealing with things. So after one night, I had put a knife very deep into my wrist and into my ankles, and I don't think it was to kill myself. It was to feel something because I couldn't feel anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I had since flushed my pills because I knew that they were, I had flushed them and gotten new ones, but then flushed them, and It was just like the beast is nasty, and I had, that was it. Like, I saw what was happening, and I wasn't gonna do it anymore. So I had been reintroduced back into stones, working with like the energies of the stones, which I didn't know much about. You know, as a kid growing up, I always knew I loved like looking at crystals and being in trees and being with the earth, but never really understood it. I just knew that I enjoyed it. And I mean, growing older, you can take in a little bit more and understand a little bit more. And I started working with the energies and how my body would react to a piece of jade or a piece of amethyst or you know, some other type of quartz.
Right.
And that was, you know, starting to work. It was just like, okay, so let me keep doing this. And I was still drinking at the time, but, you know, it was just like I would take more time out of the day.
Was this entirely self-directed learning, or were you working with somebody who worked with stones?
This was mostly self-directed, but I had been introduced by my partner at the time. And she had gotten her first Reiki attunement, which is working with your energy. It's like channeling healing energy from divine beings and divine powers and bringing it through into your body, and you can transfer that to other people or you can do it on yourself. And she had told me about these stones, and I was just like, oh, I gotta try it, you know, because she had given me Reiki before, and it was like I realized how I felt, that it was just very calming and soothing.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of like kicked me in that direction. And then you know, I spent a lot of time at the beach just by myself, and I just looked for shark's teeth, you know, and just like sat with these shark's teeth and sat with these shells. And I'd still go to the beach drunk as heck and you know, curse Poseidon and just fight him as best I could, you know, because that's, I mean, the earth has the ability to take that energy and transform it a lot easier and quicker than a human can. So that was my healing. That was it. And then I got my first Reiki attunement, and I got started doing that on me every night before I went to sleep. And it was like I could see the difference. I could feel the difference. I knew that there were still a lot of issues that are still in there, but it's just the fact that I was chipping away at all that negative force and just kind of going in towards my inner self and finding that child and just like letting that child grow.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that was it.
That's pretty impressive that you were able to start healing yourself when you weren't getting the help you needed. I think that's hard.
You know, it's still hard. But you know, the cool thing is, that group that I met in Syracuse during my first protest, one of my friends there, Mike Blake, he's also a writer. Mm-hmm. And he kind of like showed me it was okay to write whenever you wanted to, and I kind of showed him it was okay to play with stones whenever you wanted to, you know. So it's just like he has since then gone into the same path of like working with these high frequency, high energy stones to heal. And it's just like if you go into his house now, it's just like it's loaded with all these crystals and all these prayer flags and all this beautiful stuff. Which isn't like your typical like flat screen TV and all this.
Right,
it's just
right.
Like, you know, it's just we've made it a very conscious effort to fill our personal spaces with these beautiful earth things, you
yeah.
know, and it's really amazing.
Right, right.
So
you mentioned that he's a writer, and so I want to get back to your writing too. I wonder if I can ask you to read another of your poems.
Yeah.
Arlington West, Santa Barbara.
Yes. At first it was 7, then 9. Then every 5 minutes I was reminded of another. My feet kept forcing my body back and forth, dragging chains and sand. The motions became depressing. The thought, the placard, the flower, the sticker. Every visit gets sticker. Some had many, many had none. On the top of a plastic foldable table, buried in the sand, sat 2 wooden boxes filled with names waiting to be recognized. It felt like the placards were screaming to anyone that walked by, pick me, and place my name on the cross so that the whole world will know which name my family has lost. Bikers, strollers, and walkers keep shuffling past, afraid of what lay on the beach.
Thanks. Okay, so I wonder if you can describe what that event was.
So Arlington West, I believe, was started by Veterans for Peace or Gold Star Families. I honestly don't remember. But what Arlington West is, it, down in Santa Monica and in Santa Barbara, every Sunday, these volunteers, these veterans, these family members, they go out before the sun rises and they set up crosses for every single American death in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they also have a section dedicated to Iraqi and Afghani civilians because they have a lot more dead than we do. And that needs to be recognized as well. Because the other side, regardless on if they're bad or good, I hate to use the T word, but it's just they are people as well, and they have families as well. We are all humans. We are all connected. Mm-hmm. And that is something that everyone needs to realize. It doesn't matter your color, your sex, your shape, your size, whatever. It's just we are all connected, and that really needs to be emphasized in everyone's hearts. But they set up all these crosses, and they put names of people that have passed on the crosses. And they're all covered and aligned like you would see in Arlington National Cemetery. You know, and there's people that come out there every day or every Sunday, and they go see their family members, you know. And it's so sad to see because it's just, you know, it sucks that they died. It really does. It sucks that anyone has passed because of this war, because of any war. But to see these family members still grieving from 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago is heartbreaking because they go out there every weekend and they spend time with a cross amongst many other crosses on a sandy beach next to a pier in the ocean.
Yeah.
And to see that is, it'll totally it'll totally rip out your heart. You know, it's just because you know that these people haven't moved on. Most of them haven't moved on. They still think about it every day. And, you know, I mean, yeah, it's. I mean, I haven't lost any family members overseas, but I lost a lot of good friends, you know, and it's hard because at first it's all you think about, and it's just like, it's kind of one of those things where you got to realize things happen for a reason sometimes, and as horrible as the reason may be, it happened, that's it. It's, you know, it's like you can't live in the past, because if you live in the past, you're not living for the now, and you can't focus on yourself when you should be focusing. Learn from it, you know, obviously, yes, learn from it, but, you know, you have to move forward at some point. You can't dwell on horrible things all the time, because then you're just going to be dwelling on horrible things.
Right. Yeah.
You know? And I think it's very important that these family members are going out there. Don't get me wrong. But it's just, some of them you can see have worked with it, have moved forward, and they go out there because, you know, they want people to know. But there's other people that go out there and they spend all day,
mm-hmm.
you know, at a cross.
Yeah.
You know? And
right. Right.
It's a horrible feeling,
yeah.
And I can't even imagine for them. But
now, were you just a witness to this, or did you volunteer at some point? Or
we were Eli Wright and Drew Cameron and my dog Sadie and myself. We were on a tour, so we drove from Burlington, Vermont to Syracuse, all the way to San Francisco in 2.5 days.
Oh my gosh. Did the dog drive?
No, she slept in the back, but it was a bit crazy, but we were going there because we had in San Francisco we had lined up some poetry events, working with the friends of the San Francisco Public Library and Jack Hirschman, who is the former poet laureate of San Francisco, and just kind of doing some poetry reading. And then from there we went down to Santa Barbara because there's a paper maker down there, Jill Littlewood. She does a lot of sculpture, and she has a studio at her house. So we had been there the year before. And we went back and just, we were there for the week making paper in Santa Barbara, and it was really amazing. And we had missed Arlington West the year prior. So Drew and Eli and myself and Sadie, we went down there Sunday morning, and they were setting up, and it was really this unbelievable, experience. And then we went off for a little bit, and then we came back, and we spent the rest of the evening there, and we helped break down everything. And it's kind of crazy because here's these three people from out of town, and they're going there, and then, you know, just the three of us were walking back and forth. I had lost a number of friends in Iraq, and so had Eli and Drew. You know, and it's just like none of my friends had been recognized yet. And I feel it's important to honor the fact that, you know, they did pass overseas. You know, it was, regardless on whether war is just or not, it's, they did pass overseas. And it's just like, they need to be recognized so they can move forward too. So they're not lost souls.
Right.
You know, just walking around the sand of crosses.
Right. How comprehensive is this project? I mean, how many crosses are they putting up every week?
We're close to 5,000 deaths now in Iraq, and I don't know what the number is in Afghanistan, but they put up enough crosses to
represent each of
them. Wow. of the deaths. So the beach is just like completely covered in crosses.
Yeah, yeah. You do see that here sometimes. You'll see the little flags that are put up. Yeah.
Yeah. Up. I can't remember what road it is, but it's in upstate New York. There's a massive hill with woods around it, and it has this big flag that says the number, and then it has all these yellow flags scattered.
Yeah,
and
there's one in one of the guests that was on the show, Amy Huntington, who's an illustrator, lives in Williston. I don't know if they still do it, but she and her husband were keeping a flag field going for a long time. Yeah. You just mentioned the paper making that you do. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the Combat Paper Project.
Okay. When I was still in the military, I believe it was in late July, early August, I had come up here to visit a high school friend. This was shortly after I had self-mutilated. And my friend was like, have you ever heard of Iraq Veterans Against the War? And I said, yes, I have the application with me. And he's like, well, a couple of the guys live up here, and one of them just started turning his uniforms into paper. And I said, well, I have a trunk full of uniforms. So that night I'd met Drew Cameron, and I mean, it was a crazy experience because I started making paper that night, you know, started cutting up my uniforms.
Wow.
Here I am still in the military, you know, definitely beyond my boundaries.
How do you mean beyond your boundaries?
Well, I mean, I was on leave, but it was just kind of a little bit further. I went a little bit further than I should have. Just because the way things played out, I didn't stay in Connecticut. And, you know, here I am just making paper out of my uniforms. And that was it. I was just like, okay, I need to come back up here when I'm done. Drew had done a performance piece a couple weeks prior to that, to where he was standing in his uniform and he tore the uniform off his body and then ended up making it into paper. And he had learned papermaking from his father and done papermaking with Drew Matat, who was an artist. And that was it. It's just like I went back down to the base in North Carolina, and I got my paperwork a couple weeks later, and I was just like, you know what? I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm going up to Vermont. And so September 18th, I got back up to Vermont, and I was sleeping on couches and in backyards for a couple months and just going to the Green Door Studio and making paper. And that was it. It's just I made artistic expression like my life.
Yeah.
Because I had to. I didn't know what else to do, and it felt right.
Now, what happens to the paper that you make?
I bind journals, do prints, like silk screening, pulp printing, larger format sheets of paper. So over the last 3 years, we've traveled around and facilitated workshops for veterans and their family members, and got to be close to 200 veterans by now, from Vietnam to Korea to Desert Storm, Iraq, Afghanistan, Bosnia, and Cuba.
Wow.
I mean, it's just like we're trying to spread the craft of papermaking, but also the method of healing behind it, and it works. You know, it sucks because it brings back a lot of stuff. It definitely triggers a lot in other people that have never expressed themselves, like Vietnam vets. We worked with a lot of them down in San Antonio last year, in November of last year, and they've been holding on to it for 40 years,
yeah,
you know? It's
right.
Just like these people, it's like you can see very clearly that the war has messed them up and that
right.
They've never had an outlet. And to have it come back for them and just the way they react is just like a scared child,
yeah,
you know? And it's very sad.
Yeah.
So it's just like we're trying to put this out there for people to grasp onto and hopefully move forward with themselves in their own way, you know? And for people that come, they can bring their own uniforms. They can bring any article that relates to their time in that can run through a Hollander beater and put it into paper, and they keep the paper themselves. We'll teach them how to bind journals, and we'll teach them how to do pulp printing and do a creative writing workshop with them. And it's just kind of putting it there for them.
Is there a website for the Combat Paper Project?
Yes, it's www.combatpaper.org.
Okay, and I also wanted to mention that Warrior Writers has a website too, which is warriorwriters.org, I think, right?
Yes.
Okay, so we're coming down to the end of the show, and I want to talk a little bit about PTSD,
okay,
from which you suffer, and I found figures online suggesting that something like 10 to 20% of troops who fought in Iraq reported symptoms of PTSD. Is that accurate, or do you think it's bigger?
I believe it's a lot bigger.
You
than
think
that.
It's a lot bigger?
Yes.
Okay.
Any person, not just a veteran, at some point in their life will have something traumatic happen to them or someone close, and that is going to react with their body in a stressful way.
Right.
It's a natural reaction. It's a defense mechanism that the mind and the body have to kind of, like, shut you down almost for a second, because there's things that have happened that I haven't remembered, that I don't remember happening when they happened. You know, it's just kind of a way so that way you can still function. It's almost like a way of forgetting until you can deal with it at a later time in life and then move forward from there and just kind of like poof off in the wind.
Mm.
But with veterans, I believe that there's a lot of young kids that are going in and out of countries right now. And there's a lot of young kids in Iraq and Afghanistan that for the last 6, 7, 8 years, all they've known is war. You know, so that's I mean, they're getting the short end of the stick there. And it's really sad to see. But I believe the number is a lot higher than that. There's not a lot of people that want to admit it because they're scared about when they get out, if they're going to be able to get jobs, if they still want to work for the government. They, you know, it's just they're very concerned about how that label is going to affect them later on in life.
Yeah.
And by them not recognizing it at that moment when it first happens, when they know it's happening, that they have some kind of post-traumatic stress is kind of, it's going to affect them later on, because they're immediately like kicking it under the rug, which it needs to be dealt with, it needs to be embraced, it needs to be loved and
right.
nurtured. And unfortunately, it's not happening.
Yeah.
So.
I wonder, you mentioned that you had written a poem about your experience with PTSD. I wonder if you can read that now.
Yes. So this is called PTSD. In the fibers torn are memories of gun battle, where bullets scream Allah, and the deafening song of explosions dance where human flesh once stood. There have been nightmares that had made more sense, but when dream is reality, clarity is non-apparent, and the gunpowder, sacred to our veins, is by all means the means of expression, when true meaning is burnt crisp, and the screams fending for themselves are still alone in the desert.
Thanks for reading that. Do you have Chinese characters in there?
They're Reiki symbols.
Oh, they're Reiki symbols.
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
I got my second Reiki attunement, and I'm working to upgrade that here very shortly.
Oh,
so.
Well, thank you for reading that. You know, listening to that poem made me remember another question I was going to ask you. Do you think most American civilians have any understanding of what you go through in war?
I think that people that are directly connected to it, I mean, we're all directly connected to it, but like more so like family members, spouses, children, I think they have more of an understanding, and even then, I don't think they understand. And I say that because for someone that has been in the military, that's gone overseas, from the time they started basic training to going through their schools to being deployed, they have lived this lifestyle that is very regimented, very structured, very very demanding in many different ways, and what's instilled into that person is more of a less caring way. And that's very hard for a wife and a child that know love constantly and have not forgotten what love is. When I was in, I forgot what it was, and it's a horrible feeling to have. I'm still trying to find it. I mean, it's there, you know, but, and you know, I found it, but it's just like I'm still always looking for love.
Yeah.
And to understand it, but a wife or a husband that has not deployed most likely will not understand exactly what's going on. And I say that because no matter what you go through while you're overseas, you can never fully describe it. You can get really close, you can express it in many different ways, but you can't, there's a feeling behind it that you can't really explain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard, it's so hard, because I've seen families destroyed because of conflict, because the veteran doesn't know how to act, the wife doesn't know how to react, and the child's just lost in the middle, crying because they don't know what's going on.
Right.
And it's heartbreaking. And the Vermont National Guard troops are getting ready to come home soon. I saw an article in the paper saying they're trying to be home before Christmas, and that's a whole unit that's been deployed twice, I believe, within the last 3 years. They went to Iraq and then to Afghanistan, I think. I got to double check on that, but You know, it's just like, so these are people that have done multiple deployments. And, you know, the Army has it, I think they have it pretty bad because they stay over there for a lot longer. You know, for the Marines, we stay over 7 months, we come back for seven, we go back for seven, which I don't know if that's worse. But, I mean, just the fact that you're staying over in this country for 12 months, you know, that's a year out of your life that you're living in conflict.
Right. Right.
And it's hard. It's very hard. But it's there's going to be a lot of families that are going to have issues, and I'm trying to be optimistic about it, but that's just the reality of the situation. It's just like these boys, they've been away at war for a long time, and their families have been back here waiting for them to come home, you know. And it's messed up because there's going to be a lot of issues, and they're going to not know what to expect, and the people coming home aren't going to know what to expect. And
right.
it's once again heartbreaking, you know.
Yeah. There's just a sacrifice on the part of family members too, isn't there? Because they're not necessarily the ones who signed up, but they're definitely sharing that experience. Listen, John, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
Best of luck with all of your work.
Thank you.
I'm just gonna mention that next week you can tune in to hear an interview with Marlborough College Professor Emeritus of Mathematics Joe Mazur, author of the book What's Luck Got to Do with It? The History, Mathematics, and Psychology of the Gambler's Illusion. This week, instead of a Write the Book prompt, I'm going to mention the Warrior Writers Blogspot address, warriorwriters.blogspot.com. And there, alongside regular blog entries, you'll find weekly writing prompts and poetry forms and occasional shared work. The site, again, is warriorwriters.blogspot.com. And I will put that blog address up on the podcast site as well. And then John wanted to just mention a... Go ahead.
On Veterans Day, November 11th at 12 noon, Greg Delante and I will be releasing his book of poetry that Combat Paper Press published called The New Citizen Army. And the covers are all handmade from Combat Paper, and the books themselves are all hand-bound. And the covers are also printed on a letterpress out in San Francisco, the Center for Book. So him and I will be doing reading some of his poems, some of my poems, and it's at St. Michael's at 12 noon. I believe it's the McClure Building. I'm not sure, but there will be posters up around.
Okay. All right. Great. Thanks. And that's the 11th.
Yes.
So what's that, Thursday?
Thursday, November 11th, Veterans
okay.
Day.
All right. Great. Thanks for saying that. I just want to mention that if anyone's interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3, and archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. So this conversation with John will be on iTunes by tomorrow. And you can check out upcoming shows by looking at my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. If you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And finally, please remember that The Radiator is a community station, and we are here thanks to community support and involvement. More information is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby is, I believe, here in the outer room waiting for me to finish, and she's going to bring you the world of music at 3 o'clock. So please enjoy that. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.